This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Nike used the Beatles song Revolution in one of their campaigns, the Beatles sued, and their lawyers said the Beatles' position is that they don't sing jingles to peddle sneakers, beer, pantyhose, or anything else. The relationship between art and advertising is usually portrayed as antagonistic or exploitive. What is that relationship, though? It's something my next guest has thought deeply about. Dave Alsobrooks is a partner at the Paragraph Project, a market research and strategy firm in downtown Durham, and he's also an artist. His work has been celebrated in town and all around. He is on the board of the Durham Arts Guild. In fact, you can look at some of his work right now or later at our website, wunc.org, as we talk. Dave Alsobrooks, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the project that you're involved in now, the Paragraph Project. What is it?
So we do market research. We do strategy work. Our mission has been, over the past few years, and increasingly more focused on infusing strategy work and research with creativity, both in the way we set up a methodology for research and then also in how we express data and insights that we bring to our clients.
See, whenever I hear market research, what I hear is this: you're trying to figure out how to get into my head and make me buy something that maybe otherwise I wouldn't want.
Maybe the case. But the traditional way of doing that is oftentimes, for lack of a better term, rote. And again, being a creative person myself, and our belief that creativity and ideas come from anywhere, we try to, again, be creative in how we get to insights. So by doing so, it's our philosophy that we find new insights. So essentially, we find a new way into your head in a good way.
And then the strategy, to figure out a way, okay, now that I know that,
exactly,
what do I do outside to sort of attract you to whatever it is I'm doing?
Right? So if we're uncovering new insights, in other words, using the same techniques over and over that have been used for decades, we're essentially going to find the same insight or the same attribute, let's say, or whatever it may be with a product or a service. So by finding a new insight, we're able to create a new type of strategy and a new way to find a point of differentiation for a product or a service.
And these strategies are going to result in some kind of media. There's going to be something before my eyes and something that will appeal to my ears. That's going to bring me into the project. And there's always been this tension about that kind of work, right? Mm-hmm. That billboard, right? Mm-hmm. That ad, that newspaper ad, radio, TV ad. And whether or not the creative work that goes into that is art, or mm-hmm. whether because it's directed at a particular product, right, it has a mission, that somehow it's disqualified.
Mm-hmm. I would go back again to the notion of traditional forms and what we have experienced over the past, you know, few decades. So billboards are not always, let's say, art. But if I go back to the previous point of finding new insights, finding a new way into your head, perhaps there's a different way to relate to you. So it may not be with the traditional form of advertising. It may be, you know, we're talking about art and advertising. In art, you may have an installation versus a painting on a wall. So it's a little bit more of an immersive experience. So in recent years, you know, the advent of the internet blew everything open, and just different forms of advertising, different forms of media that aren't traditional forms. Part of that gap has been closed, I think, in the way that people experience advertising. Sometimes they may not even realize it.
Well, if I get back to the point we made in our introduction, you know, when the Beatles Beatles Enterprises, right, mm-hmm. became exercised at Nike using Revolution that way, you know, you could say that the Beatles were pop artists who were selling records. I mean, right. It wasn't about art. It was about being million record sellers. They knew a hook, and they could write them well, and they were a charming group of lads, as we used to say back then.
Right. So at some point, I'm sure they leveraged some sort of marketing to sell those records. So it's hard to say that, you know, marketing or advertising is all evil. We all want to promote something about ourselves, if it's our point of view or it's just the way we feel about dinner or whatever. There's a little bit of spin that goes on as part of human nature, I think.
Well, let's take it from the other side, too. You know, sort of the premise is, at least part of the premise is, well, it's not art if you're trying to get me to do something if you're trying to persuade. But doesn't the artist have something in mind? Aren't they? Shouldn't they? Shouldn't an artist be trying to communicate something?
Right. I think you're right. And personally, I've been through that process myself. As I started creating fine art, making art, it was more about what was in my head and about these very sort of academic paintings that were about making paintings, and they weren't really communicating much. But I was sort of forcing that vision or point of view that I had into the space where people were, more like an advertisement, let's say, that is sort of thrust into the environment. And at some point, as marketing and art sort of merged for me, it became more about communicating a message and making sure that when somebody viewed it, they had something to take away and consider. And so I think, you know, if it's really art, who knows? I'm not going to define that necessarily today, but to say that, you know, a message is communicated and it's relevant and I take away something as a viewer, I think it more approaches art than what we might say is, you know, a conventional definition of advertising and marketing and self-promotion.
When maybe we can, another way to get at this is to take a look at a particular campaign that the Paragraph Project was involved in. You did a national campaign for a national mattress brand.
Right.
So tell us that story.
So this is an example of, or a good example of, a new way to find new insights. So we were charged with a really conventional, traditional problem, how to create a better ad. And we certainly delivered on that assignment because these folks were our clients. But getting into the topic of selling mattresses and what people were looking for, it became clear to us that it wasn't just about the mattress. Folks that had a bad night's sleep were hesitant to blame their mattress, mostly because it was the most expensive part of what was either contributing or taken away from their night's sleep. So the dog barking, the train, it was too hot, etc. Nobody wanted to blame the $3,000 mattress. But so we employed some different techniques to sort of get at that problem, from asking screenwriters to write short stories about sleep to assembling an expert panel that included a dream artist and interior designer who, you know, talked about how master bedrooms are no longer created for sleep. They're created for connecting to the office or watching television or anything other than sleep. So it became apparent to us that this particular brand, this particular company, needed to sell a good night's sleep rather than just a mattress. And, you know, I mentioned they made better ads at that point, or more effective ads, let's say, but they also ended up changing their entire retail strategy as a result of this new insight that they got. So it became less about a sea of mattresses in the store and more about a few mattresses to get the point across, some diagnostic tools, and then a more holistic approach to a night's sleep, from aromatherapy to cooling pajamas and, you know, all sorts of stuff that came out of the insight of looking for a better night's sleep, not just a better mattress.
Well, you know, if you think this through, and I'm sure you did not have all of this in mind, what I'm about to say in mind, when you were putting together the mattress campaign, but if you think it through, if we then see that campaign and think more about sleep than about bedrooms, then maybe we're forced to think about how we're spending our time, whether or not my master bedroom should be connected to the office and to the big wide world, or if there shouldn't be a spot in my life sequestered to rest and to sleep. I mean, in a way, rethinking that does have what would I say, the value that we attribute to art in allowing us to think about things in new ways.
Right. And ponder that and see what it means in my life. And how, you know, like you said, what are the things that I do need to change? Maybe I, like you said, I do sort of unplug my computer or unplug my phone, you know, an hour before I go to bed. But this particular company was able to be the vehicle for that message for these folks. So in essence, not a heavy-handed advertisement or promotion, salesy type, you know, message, but one of, here's how you get a better night's sleep. We can be a part of that, but there are other things that you can do as well.
There have been industries as well that, as a result of their marketing strategy, this kind of thinking around the table, have rethought what they were, so that the airline that says, we're not in the business of flying, we're in the we're in the hospitality business, then right. begins to link to other things. And you can imagine, oh, let's say a big power company that said, we're not in the business of just generating electricity, which you can do with coal, but suppose you were to think of yourself as an energy business, and then right. the sun and the wind would become open to you.
Right.
Just now, I'm just putting that out there as an example.
Right, right. So, you know, if you open up those possibilities, it really opens up, to be honest, different forms of revenue for the company as well. So, but it's a fine line, just like anything, to say now we're going to be an expert in power and now we're going to be an expert in wind or solar or whatever. It really has to come from, you know, what the essence of that company is, what the, you know, with the ethos or the real purpose. This is what we talk about a lot, is having a brand purpose rather than a brand positioning.
Mm-hmm.
And that purpose will allow you to grow,
right?
Whereas a positioning sometimes boxes you in.
You can't ignore your competencies. So if you're
right.
not good at that, even though you now reimagine yourself as an energy company, you know, which where the sky would be the limit,
right?
You have to say, yeah, but do we do wind
right.
and solar?
And you may fail at that attempt because it's not part of your core competency. And the other side is that a consumer probably won't believe you if you come out with something that is, you know, 180 degrees from where you're at.
But if you had a few bucks left over at the end of the month, you might invest in that and
sure.
get better. Who
sure.
knows? Well, listen, we'll keep this conversation going. Dave Alsobrooks, a partner at the Paragraph Project and a local artist here in Durham. Just ahead, we're going to talk about some of his projects as a Southern conceptual artist. And you can see some of that work at our website, WUNC.org. You know, each Monday, WUNC also publishes a column at our website called Mad Men Mondays, written by Duke's Hartman Center, and that studies advertising history, so you might check that out as well. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today I'm talking about art and advertising with my guest, Dave Alsobrooks, a partner at the Paragraph Project, a market research strategy firm. He's also a local artist. I want to talk about that because you have been interested in art, I understand, since you were a kid, right?
Yeah, I can remember as a young child, probably as early as first grade or kindergarten, thereabouts, playing with art supplies. Always got art supplies at Christmas time, and drawing pictures in class and having people sort of sit around and even watch it at times. So it's always been something that I've been interested in.
Were you talking actively about pursuing that as a young man?
I don't think I had necessarily talked about it as much as it was just obvious that's what I
yeah.
was going to do. But obviously I had conversations about going to school for it.
Well, it might also be obvious that you might have to go into the Navy since your grandfather and father were both in the Navy, right?
Yeah, yeah. An interesting part of family history, I guess, is there were two generations of folks who went to the Navy, and then I chose to go to art school and sort of take my time doing it. So a little bit of a contrast there.
How did that go over with the family?
Interestingly, it went over very well with my folks. My dad was creative and interested in arts, and while he played football, JV and varsity at the same time, I'm not sure how you do that, but was also...
Did you have a very small JV team?
Yeah,
I
guess.
That means.
Well, he was the center, so that was like the toughest
Whoa.
Part to be. But anyway, was interested in art and played the trumpet and all sorts of stuff. But ended up in the Navy, I think, is part of prodding from the rest of the family. And when I came along, he was very much in support of my going to art school.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was entering design school specifically with the thought of having a career afterward and being able to apply myself creatively. And he would always sort of prod me on, you know, you need to be a painter, not a designer. And
wow.
It was kind of okay, I'll get there.
Well, what did he do?
So he became after he repaired aircraft in the Navy, and later went on to work in CNC tool grinding. So something very technical, and but was able to, even as a service repair guy on these huge machines, was able to really travel the world, and so maybe that factored into some of his. Acceptance of what
but,
I was going
well,
for.
Well, more than that. He was promoting it, and he was promoting something that was less practical than what you had in mind, a man
right.
who had to make sure the planes flew and the tools spun.
Right.
That's a very practical thing. Do you think there's any kind of a sort of a reaction to that? Don't ever do what I've done, son?
Maybe. You know, We're father sons, so we relate to each other. So I took that to heart, and you know, while I still got my degree in design, and I'm obviously doing something different than that now. I've always sort of, when people ask me what kind of an artist I am, conceptual artist is kind of a weird occupation. So a lot of times, you know, I'll say I fancy myself a painter, but that's how I approach my art. But it may be other things.
If you put conceptual artist on your tax form, however, it justifies the very low income that
exactly,
you report.
Exactly.
So there's that. You showed signs early on, I think, of being, you know, sort of engaged in marketing. I guess you do. You drew a picture of a plane, but you didn't leave it at that.
Yeah, I've referenced this just a second ago. Folks sitting around, or kids rather, sitting around. I don't think we're folks when we're 6 years old. Yeah. Kids sitting around class watching me draw this photo, and I mentioned my dad's travels. He was flying on a plane a lot. This was back in the 80s, early 80s, and I drew this plane in the sky, and I made sure that I included the Piedmont logo on there, which I'm dating myself a little bit.
Yeah.
If you know what it looks like, you know what it looks like.
You know what it looks like, but it was somehow in your head, and that was what a plane looked like.
Yeah. Yeah, and the logos and the colors and all that were definitely a part of it.
Wow. So you did go to fine art. You studied fine arts and fine art in college. Tell me about that. What kind of education did you receive?
I have always been a big fan of the education I got. It was a fine art program, but it was a design school. So we spent the first 2 years without a computer in front of us. So we learned a lot of hand skills. You know, I mentioned drawing when I was 6 years old, always being sort of, everybody knew that I drew, lifted up in that capacity even, but went to school and actually learned how to draw. It was somewhat of a transformative experience for me. So a figure drawing class or a painting class or a three-dimensional design class, being part of a graphic design curriculum, I feel like has benefited me greatly. Near term, as I left school and entered, you know, the real world as a production artist, but then years later, as now a conceptual artist, we'll say it, and a market strategist with the Paragraph Project, it's helped.
I'm going to push this point a little bit more, the idea of a design artist versus a conceptual artist or a fine artist. I mean, in each case, you're talking about having some kind of message to convey,
right,
a design that's going to be, yeah, in some ways useful, at least if not to other people to recreate this model. So mm-hmm. I've got the plane that flies. There's something in mind that you want to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
How are they really different, and how so?
Yeah, so I'll even go back to the beginning topic of this tension between art and advertising, and let's say designers and artists. There's a lot of tension there too, maybe as much as there is between advertising and art. To me personally, there isn't a lot of difference. It's how you apply what you're thinking and the message that you're trying to convey. So I believe, for me, having a designer's point of view helps me create better art, in my mind, better art. Art that is more communicative, that provides a message, is aesthetically pleasing in the way that it presents this idea, or at least thought-provoking. So to me, the sort of center point for all of that is this notion of design. And you can design a research methodology, you can design an artifact of that process, you can design a painting, you can design an ad. So it's all about sort of the execution and what medium that you choose. So instead of painting, it could be an ad. You typically wouldn't see that contrast, let's say, on a gallery wall. But it's really the medium that's chosen.
Andy Warhol made a couple bucks on that.
Sure. Sure.
And theoretically, the message was about advertising and this kind of printing that happens
yep.
to us. But certainly advertising was an important part of his message.
Right.
I mean, a kind of an arch narrative that it creates. Well, so let's take both ends of the spectrum. It's fairly easy for people to argue that when it's propaganda, the prettiness on the page, because it was directed at a very specific message, I want you to think this, it's about persuasion. Many of us will disqualify that as art, however pretty it is, however creative it might have been. Let's look at the other side of the spectrum, an expressionist artist who says, I don't care what you get from this. I don't care if you ever know what was going on in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this thing, and it's on the gallery wall, and it's art. And somehow we have no trouble calling that art if you didn't intend anything, or if you would not argue that there was anything intentional about this.
Maybe it's easier to be mad at something if you don't have that takeaway. You know, I'm not responding to anything because I have no idea what you were thinking when you placed a pencil mark on this canvas or whatever. So, you know, like anything else, it's a tricky line. Sometimes an abstract piece of art that, you know, people might discredit as art might mean something to somebody because it reminds them of a sunset they saw in Spain, for example, mm-hmm. something like that. It's hard to discredit either. Again, I think it's really just the medium that you chose. How effectively are you communicating something?
You studied fine art and design. You came out of college. What did you do next?
Became a production artist, essentially. So that's just a lot of clicking and dragging a mouse. And, you know, the interesting thing was we all know what we know. And you feel like you're working on 6-week deadlines in school and it's a rush. And getting out of school and just being trial by fire and just learning how all that stuff worked. I think I had perfect vision all the way up until then. And within 6 months, I had glasses. So it was pretty intense, a lot of more fast-paced work, which, again, sets you up for, making sprints in business or whatever later on.
You do something called project-based work, mm-hmm. Artwork. What does that mean?
So when I first started making art out of school, it was, like I mentioned, more academic, more about what's in my head. They were essentially abstract and monochromatic, if you can get any more base foundational than that. And I kept art and advertising and marketing separate. So in other words, I would approach my job, turn that switch off, flip on the art switch, do something completely different. Over the years, those eventually started melding and a lot of overlap occurred until finally, the way I say it, it's just one big day. So it's a blend of taking a more artful approach to marketing and then taking a more strategic approach to how I make art. And so the project-based work came around as a result of a particular series, but essentially it's, I want to investigate a topic. There's something that I want to say about this topic. Or I want to create a conversation around this topic. So what is the best way that I can create art to provoke that conversation? And it may be an installation with sound. It may be a series of paintings. It may be an event. It may be, you know, who knows what, again, depending on what that subject matter is.
Well, you did one series called A Culture of Corruption, mm-hmm. Portrait of Political Figures, which you can see at our website, wnc.org. But tell us about that project.
So that was the genesis of that approach, or the approach of taking on project-based work. And the interesting thing about it was it was really a deep dive for me into a concept to say, I want to make conceptual art. So all of these paintings, they were approximately 6 feet tall, about 4 feet wide. They were all portraits. So very large portraits. They were essentially headshots, almost like a mugshot. In fact, one of them was derived from a mugshot. But they were all political figures, to keep that train of thought, mugshots. They're all political figures from a specific period of time. The work dates back to about 2006. So the materials in each painting were conceptually tied to the person. So there was a painting done in motor oil. There was a painting done in shredded emails. There was a painting done in telephone wire.
Well, but tell us who these figures
okay,
are.
Okay.
That's the
punchline.
Push me on that. Yeah.
So George Bush was painted in motor oil. Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general at that time and advocate for wiretapping, was created in telephone wire. Karl Rove was depicted in these shredded emails. There was allegedly a lot of email that transpired over an alternate email server rather than the public one that they supposedly should have been using. And so I was able, through some research, to find 4 or 5 images of specific emails. So they were, again, not just shredded email, to say conceptually, they were actual emails that had occurred on that server that I was making the point about. And I think there were 11 of them in total. But the one that's easiest to get the approach, though, was of Michael Chertoff. Went to New Orleans in 2005 after Katrina, did some volunteer work. We actually have a nonprofit as a result of that now. But the thing I couldn't escape was the waterline. So the portrait of Michael Chertoff, I actually sat it in a pond for the exact same amount of time that New Orleans was underwater. So rather than depict a water line and say, I hope you got it. It's a water line. I paint really well. Actually stuck the painting in a pond and just let it create the water line under similar approximate situations as what happened in New Orleans, as far as time length goes.
How important would it be for me who saw that work of art to know what you just told me now, to appreciate that work?
I think there is something to information and understanding the backstory. I typically make it a point to illustrate relevant information with the shows that I put up. So in other words, with each of those paintings, for example, there was a large hang tag that hung beside it that basically explained what that person's place in this so-called culture of corruption, why they had been inducted into this Hall of Fame, if you will. There have been other series where I've done that as well to provide, you know, sort of a map to say, here's your way into this piece, right. You know.
Well, that brings me to this other point in the discussion, something you hear so often. I let the art speak for itself, mm-hmm. as though something can be created and come to you and then create an image in your mind without any backstory at all. I mean, we have to have something in common, right? There has to be a narrative in order for this to communicate at all. It's possible that it'll trigger a random thought because right. It looked like something else that yeah. The artist didn't have in mind. But really, that's not the commerce going on between the artist and the viewer, right?
For me personally, context is of great importance, be it art, be it advertising, whatever. You know, when we present an insight to a client at the Paragraph Project, it's all about the context in which that insight comes forth, the research that was done so that you understand. As an artist, it's important for me for a viewer to have the base story, you know, just to understand some of the facts and again try to report those objectively. Here are some of the facts. Here's the interpretation. Hopefully that spurs, you know, a conversation.
And I think anybody, I mean, this is an easy thing to understand. I mean, again, you sort of try to believe that art should just be sort of spring whole cloth and mean something to me. But anybody knows that if you studied anything about a period, so medieval art looks kind of silly and old-fashioned to you and stale.
I think it's kind of cool.
But it looks kind of cool. And the more you know about it, the context yes. In which it was created and what was going on, both the technological developments but also the political and social milieu, all of a sudden that stuff becomes far more interesting and mm-hmm. powerful. So it's a little foolish to say we don't need to know anything and appreciate art.
Right. So as advertising, as art, sort of for me, one of those periods of time that meant a lot to me was the Soviet Union back in the early 1900s. And this was a focus of interest for me when I was in school and did some research on it. And, you know, it was part of, let's say, a senior project then. But understanding the context of what was going on in that time completely changed the way I look at that work. You know, a Rodchenko, for example, that people point to as a style guide for creating art for bicycles and shoes now. Understanding at that point in time, the artist really had all the power. They were sort of not a cog in the wheel. It was up to them to get whatever message out. And it wasn't always what other people wanted them to say necessarily. But again, it's just this this overlap between messaging and art and understanding, again, that context to say, this is what's going on. This is what we're trying to improve upon.
What does art look like when you have to operate at two levels to get it past the censors? What does it look like when you're in a world in the 60s in New York where, you know, say anything you want, nobody's going to stop you?
Yeah.
You come up with very different looking art.
Yep, yep. And, you know, to marry that back to, you know, my day job at the Paragraph Project, that's what our mission is with, you know, finding a new insight. It's that new way of looking at something or that new connection that maybe hasn't been made yet. So as an artist or as a marketer, what have you, it's understanding that there is a different way to connect with people.
Your context also is, as a Southern artist, you mm-hmm. take that very seriously.
Yeah, that's become increasingly more of a focus over the past, you know, I'd say 4 or 5 years. Understanding that I grew up in a period of time in the 70s and 80s that wasn't really far unlike what my parents went through in the 50s and 60s. So, you know, I recount that being in school, the schools were, you know, obviously integrated, but the town was still segregated. And there are lots of these sort of quirky binaries that are a part of growing up here, part of living here. And as the world becomes smaller, it's how are those things going to shake out? And so it's sort of the notion of the South reflecting onto this modern world, and then that modern world reflecting back onto it. It's an interesting time to be here and try to understand and grapple with its place.
Well, and to put it in context is important because there are people now who have grown up outside of that
right.
particular experience, and mm-hmm. yet the impact of that is still rippling its way through in imagery and sound. It's there. It's part of your life. You just don't know particularly, if you're younger, what it's referring to.
Right. So I've tried in a few pieces, a few projects. There's a notion of preserving something versus a notion of calling something out and putting point of views about a subject. And so there's, as I mentioned, there are different ways of pursuing these topics, and that's the beauty of project work to me and conceptual work to me is to say, I'm interested in investigating this topic this way and putting this out into the world and hopefully making a connection.
I'll tell you what, we'll take a break here, and when we come back, we'll see how you investigated the Confederate flag along those lines when my conversation with Dave Also Brooks continues. He's a partner at the Paragraph Project, a local artist as well. You can see his work at our website, wunc.org, and you can hear more of our conversation in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. I am talking with Dave Also Brooks, a partner of the Paragraph Project and local artist here in Durham. His work's at our website at wunc.org as we talk about the project you've done, including one that investigated your understanding and your ideas about, and other people's ideas about, the Confederate flag. Tell mm-hmm. us about it.
So the project was called Heritage Not Hate, which actually refers to a specific phrase that came into being. My experience was South Carolina. I grew up in South Carolina. The Confederate flag flew on the state capitol there until about the year 2000, I believe, at which point it was repositioned onto the grounds in a memorial. So a huge debate took place about either taking this flag down or leaving it up, and it sort of went on for years. But this phrase, heritage not hate, became something that was fairly ubiquitous in the state. It was on bumper stickers and windows and homemade signs, like you name it. It was always positioned, though, as a declarative statement at that time. So basically it was in defense of – that point of view was in defense of leaving the flag up under the premise that it's about heritage, it's not about hate. So I wanted to investigate the topic. Many times I've seen this topic investigated. It's usually this is my point of view on the topic. Now go form your own or whatever. What I wanted to do in the piece was to portray several points of view at once. So I posed the phrase heritage not hate as a question and said, well, which heritage are we talking about? What kind of hate are we talking about? Is this hate? Is it not? And I don't make any designs on solving the problem. Like a lot of things, it's fairly complex. I posed more questions. I believe I say that in the artist statement associated with the project, more questions I admit. But the idea, again, being putting, in this case, sort of four points of view about the flag on the wall at once.
Well, talk about those.
Okay.
How did it look? Yeah.
So an easy way to do that was to create different colorways or color schemes for the flag. So the points of view really dealt – it starts with the original flag itself, red, white, and blue – and saying this is the historical part of, you know, where the flag first originated. There are things that happened. There were battles. There were people that died. There were people that stood up for what they believed in. There were opposing forces. This really did happen. So that's kind of the original one left as is. The other sort of take an interpretive approach to say, here's how people have reacted to that flag since. It's hard to escape what happened during the Civil Rights era and say that the flag wasn't a part of it. It was a part of it. It, again, things happened. People died. People were hurt. People stood up for what they believed in. But very different situation and more recent and obviously more documented through different types of media. So that flag was yellow to say it was sort of the image of that flag, the history associated with it became tarnished at that point. It was redirected from where it had originally surfaced. And then the other two – points of view essentially took on the main cultural forces that were at play in more recent years. So a white version and a black version to say, you know, what if that flag only stood for the heritage of culture, or what if it stood for actually reclaiming one's culture and using it as a defiant symbol of perseverance? So again, four different points of view on the wall at once. This is another one where a little key or a guide was required. Each flag, it's commonly referred to as the stars and bars. The bars, in this case, had lots of different types of imagery that helped encapsulate that particular point of view, sort of woven through. So I provided a little key. Some of you are familiar with this idea of like a high school yearbook portrait where everybody's got a little number. That was the approach for this, to say, here are, you know, obscure historical references were made. So here is what happened here. And then in some cases, a little bit more commentary from me, from my personal experiences.
So what this does, and I think it goes right back to that conversation we had about let the art speak for itself. Let's mm-hmm. take a look at this Confederate flag as a work of art, right? Mm-hmm. This design. When it speaks for itself to different people in very different ways, which is obviously the centerpiece of your project, in which the authors of Heritage Not Hate don't seem to take into account. They're saying, no, it's our heritage and we're a... Oh, wait, there's another us here. Because yeah. if I'm a descendant of an enslaved person, that heritage is far different, and
right.
it is a hateful one indeed.
Right.
So not to account for that is to see the art speaking for itself from your point of view and not understanding the impact it has mm-hmm. On other people.
Which really was the contrast I tried to draw in undertaking the project, to say, I'm not going to put just my point of view out there. I'm going to try to, again... Not fully. We say this a lot of times to our clients. We're never going to understand your business as well as you do. It's our job to pull as much out of you as we can. You are the keepers of what is really fundamental about your business. But in this case, I tried to understand different points of view well enough to portray them in a way that there was enough meat there, you know, to respond to.
It also sheds light on this seeming dyad between propaganda on the one side and art as an expression, you know, sort of a pure expression on the other. Even in this case, if you didn't want to bring me to a particular point of view, you've challenged, mm-hmm. right? It's a challenge to a prevailing point of view mm-hmm. that says, at the very least, you need to consider more than what that bumper sticker says. And so you're persuading, I mean, in a way. Mm-hmm. What artist wouldn't? How could you not have something to say if you're an artist?
Right. Well...
Which is not to say, tell me how to think, but it is to say that this bumper sticker requires more thought than it suggests.
Yeah. And so there are, with this particular project, there are levels of immersion that the viewer can have. You know, they can take it from afar. They're noticeable from very far away. I actually used the same proportions, not the same dimensions, but the same proportions as Jasper John's flag. So there's a little obscure art history reference in there, but... They're approximately...
Maybe, oh, so you stole from Jasper Johns. That was a twist.
I did.
I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Just the proportion, the magic golden proportion, I guess. Yeah. But as four pieces hanging at once, each piece was about 45 inches wide. So you can look at them from far, understand what it is, yeah. or you can approach them. You can look at the imagery, start to understand that a little bit more. You can delve even deeper to go into the placards that are on either side of each painting and really dive into... what happened on this day and you know, 18 whatever, and understand the piece on that level.
So here's another distinction that people often make when trying to qualify something as art, that it in some way comes as a surprise to the artist to some degree or another, that there was a concept, but that in pursuing the work itself, things reveal themselves in a way that a designer might not. A designer is always working to the end and tries mm-hmm. to get there. Mm-hmm. So let's take this project as an example. Were there surprises for you? Did things happen to you along the way that changed your initial idea?
Sure. I would say in the making of the pieces as well as once they had been made, some of the conversations that I ended up having with people who saw them. A lot of the work that I do is experimental in the sense of the material. So the culture of corruption pieces, each one of those was an experiment. It was the first time I had ever used any of those materials. And it was like, whatever happens, we're going to roll with it. In the case of this, a little more conventional, but still there were surprises with image transfers and such that, you know, I don't know exactly how this is going to turn out, but we're gonna work with this. Even using roofing cement as one of them, but just because it's black and it's shiny and I liked it. So, but again, not knowing how that was going to turn out. So, and then also doing the historical research to provide the context for those pieces enlightened me to lots of things that I had not been aware of before, and certainly shaped my point of view on the subject as a whole. And then also hearing stories from folks who were viewing those, folks who were reluctant to, let's say, walk into my studio and see them, but pushing themselves to do that, and then opening up to me and telling me a story from 10 years ago that had changed their life. Those types of things are where you feel, as an artist, that you've done your job, per se.
Dave Olsobrooks is with me. He is a partner in the Paragraph Project. His work that we're talking about, many of the pieces are online at WNC.org. Tell us about the Highway 1 project. That's a fascinating project.
So that's one about preserving. Highway 1 is a stretch of road in South Carolina. I guess there's Highway 1 here, too. I focused on a stretch from the state line, which is sort of near Sherrall, South Carolina, down to Columbia. And I'd actually been to Columbia on a trip, and someone asked me, which way did I go? And I mentioned the interstate, and they said, oh, you have to go back on Highway 1. So I went back on Highway 1, was really sort of overcome with this sense of isolation and just feeling way far out there, which I'm normally okay with, but it was really palpable this particular day. And I knew that I'd been on that stretch of road as a child probably a handful of times, not just once. So it was just interesting to have a different feeling as an adult. So I had to go back to Columbia, so I made sure that I went down on Highway 1, took a camera with me, and lengthened my trip by a great deal, but tried to document everything and anything and everything that interested me along the way, and that also contributed to that feeling of isolation, to try to capture a forgotten place, essentially.
So, and but you also installed church pews as part of this project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this piece eventually became expressed through an installation. So it was a slide projection of these images. On the trip, it was just oppressively hot and humid. Everything was really the color just baked out of it. Even the highway is essentially white, not black, just because of just it's so hot. So I tried to convey that in these photographs, which were really washed out. They're projected on an old blue tarp that's painted white. And then you sit in a church pew and hear ambient noise of the day. So the church pew originated because churches were really the only landmarks that you would encounter along the way. A house here, a trailer here, a convenience store here. But the thing that really stood out and that were different, the only things that were really different were churches.
So that's my experience then in experiencing this installation is from the church pew.
Yeah, to sit in a church pew. The photographs, obviously, just by the nature of the trip, start out in the morning, end up in the evening. So the ambient noise sort of takes you through that day as well. Mm-hmm. So you might hear birds chirping in the morning, and it gets around to cicadas at night. So you really get a feeling of just an entire day transpiring.
That, by the way, is how most NPR radio pieces are put together. That soundtrack is actually in the NPR library, and
yes,
then reporters just change the words.
That's right.
That's how we've done it for years. So, but that sounds great. So you are also, you mentioned this earlier, co-founder of a project that gets outside of the realm of art, although maybe you consider it well within those boundaries as well, co-founder of Bayou Rescue. Tell us about it.
So that started in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. And my wife and I were living in Boone at the time in what became sort of a quasi-sabbatical, not necessarily intended that way. But at the time, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had time. And watching the news, we were compelled to do something. And we decided to go down to the Gulf and work. Our focus was going to be on helping animals and helping people who were caring for animals. So not forgetting about those people who are already there working. And we let people know that we were going to travel down there. We started a blog. It was called Bayou Rescue. That was going to just document our trip. And it really snowballed from there. We ended up making four or five trips. We responded soon after that to Hurricane Rita and have done some other large-scale responses in that vein. Our mission has evolved over the years, and now we're more of a liaison type group. So we network, and it's all about connecting people to resources, the right resources. Again, we try to make sure that we're hooking them up with the right thing, the right resources at the right time. So we work primarily through the Red Cross now in 13 counties here in North Carolina. So single family home fire response, body rescue help develop new protocols that include pets as part of the process and as part of the protocol for what actually happens. And our focus has always been to try to keep the pets with the family through a transitional period. And, you know, everyone does better that way. The pets do better. The family does better. A pet or an animal doesn't have to be put down at a shelter to make room for another animal.
I guess that's what had been happening typically. You're of course, most concerned about the humans. And,
yeah.
But then what do we do with these animals? So what do you do? I mean, how does that complicate the picture for rescue and resettlement of individual people?
It can be complicated. It doesn't have to be, though. There are little things that can change. For example, you know, we worked with the Red Cross to develop this protocol, so we didn't just hand over a report and say, this is what you ought to be doing, and it makes no sense based on what their current protocols are. We worked pretty closely with the Orange County Red Cross at the time to develop this protocol. It's completely replicable, so it can be scaled statewide. It could be scaled beyond, which is another part of what we'd like to do. But little things can happen. So part of that protocol was the Red Cross will send you to a hotel for 3 days during that transitional period. But they didn't necessarily have a beat on what current pet-friendly hotels were out there. So it's send them to a pet-friendly hotel, and Body Rescue will pick up the pet fee and thereby not inconvenience the family who's already been inconvenienced to such a great deal. So, again, little things like that. And they've been an awesome working partner over the past, you know, few years.
So now you're setting up systems. But that first trip down to New Orleans, what were you doing?
I say we went down on the first wave of crazy animal people. And I say that affectionately. But, you know, being down on that first wave of folks meant that we got plugged into national organizations right out of the gate, which was completely unheard of.
And you were actually rescuing animals.
Yeah, we worked. Different trips had different focus. So the first trip, we worked primarily with Best Friends, which is a national organization based out of Utah, at a staging ground in Mississippi where there were 300 or 400 animals by the time we were out of there. Subsequent trips, we were in New Orleans, you know, working on rescuing animals. And working with other organizations.
Did a lot, too. There were a couple of hundred, right, maybe that first time?
Yeah, there were tons of folks that were down there.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Alsobrooks is a partner at the Paragraph Project and co-founder of Bayou Rescue. You can see his art and find out more about Bayou Rescue by going to our website, WNC.org. And since we've been talking about art and advertising, we should point out that each Monday, WUNC publishes a column on our website called Mad Men Mondays. It's written by Duke's Hartman Center, and it studies advertising history. And that column recaps the latest Mad Men episodes so that you can look at the pictures of original 1960s ads that the Mad Men make reference to in the program. That's at our website as well, WUNC.org. Thanks for listening to our program. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.